Points North. Host and producer Peter North spends an hour speaking with those who make their living in the field of music. Performers, producers, agents, authors, offering various points of view on making music, the music business, and the world of music in general. Peter is an award-winning music journalist and producer with a long and impressive career. Here he is with today's program.
Hello and welcome to Points North. Before we get to talking about and with today's guest, Sid Griffin, I'll let you know that this is the final new installment of Points North, which has been running on the CKUA radio network for 4 years to the month. I'd like to thank all the musicians, producers, broadcasters, music publishers, festival producers, music journalists, and authors who accepted invitations to join me on this program and enlighten us about the making of music and the many facets of the music business and industry. Thanks to Brian Dunsmore, who initiated the process of getting Points North off the ground, and Paul Duke Pates, who has been the technical director and my foil as we put over 150 Points North programs together. Simply put, it has been a blast, and thanks to you, the listener, for all your positive feedback. Following the spring fundraiser, CKUA will be airing what we think is some of the best of Points North that will take us up to the fall fundraiser. Today, we welcome musician, journalist, bandleader, and author Sid Griffin to Points North. I first became aware of Sid Griffin's talents in the mid-80s when he was fronting a country rock band with both pop and punk sensibilities called the Long Riders. That band was signed to Island Records. In the early 90s, Griffin moved to London, England, and he's been there ever since, making great music with his acoustic band, the Cole Porters, writing books, and raising a family. Sid Griffin, thank you for joining us on Points North, which happens to be the last recorded interview for this series that's been running for 4 years. So it's great to have you put a wrap on what's been, I think, a fun 4 years. So thanks for joining us from London, England today.
Well, thank you very much. This is great.
Let's talk about your early years in America, born in Kentucky, and what were the first sounds you were drawn to, and what were the cornerstones of your formative years in music?
I was ill as a kid and pre-Beatles, and fairly seriously ill, and was stuck in a room in the house. And I had a transistor radio for company as my mother and the family went around their business, and I missed a fair bit of school. So I listened to this AM radio, two AM radio stations in Kentucky, WKLO and WAKY. And I just learned a lot of things. I learned that there's something called a format, because I learned that after 3 hours they would play a hit record again. And I learned that the news didn't change that much hour to hour back 50 years ago. And I learned that a DJ on an African-American R&B station, WLOU, who was Wild Bill in the afternoon, was the same guy on the weekend that was Sweet William playing gospel music. I recognized, wait, that's the same voice. And he's just yelling a little bit less for the gospel and yelling a little bit more for the raucous R&B. So I was into music before the Beatles, and which is very rare for people my age. Very.
No kidding.
People get a chill when they hear a song by The Clash or Prince, and people my age get a chill when they hear an old song that reminds them of you know, Beatles or a Motown song. Well, I can hear, you know, Leslie Gore doing It's My Party, or Itsy Beanie Teeny Weenie Polka Dot Bikini by Brian Hyland. Remember them, they were hits. I was just a tiny little guy, but I remember.
How about country music influences, or at least maybe if they weren't consciously registering with you, that years later, sounds of what was created in your backyard came home to roost?
Although I'm known as a roots rock guy, an elementalist, it's not just the main river of 4/4 rock and roll timed music I like. I like R&B, and I like country and western a great deal. I figure they're two sides of the same coin, the white man's blues and the African-American blues. And in my neighborhood, there was a wonderful lady that was a cook, an African-American lady that was a wonderful cook. We always used to go eat her food. And she had a gospel show on the weekends, believe it or not. And it was called Sing Ye with an exclamation point. So I was introduced through her to Mahalia Jackson and Clara Ward and all these, you know, the five Blind Boys of Alabama and the Swan Silvertones. And I was just a kid. And I didn't realize other people sort of didn't know this stuff in the white community. And then up the street, there was a tavern that is sadly gone called Bowers. And it had been there since 1869, and it made it to its 100th anniversary. I think it made it to the 120th anniversary, and now it's gone. And they had a bluegrass band there every once a week. And it was really wonderful to hear that band. Of course, I thought that band at the time, Peter, were really old men, and they were probably guys in their mid-20s to mid-30s. And now I'm in my 50s. But as a boy, they looked like old, old men. But I look back and think, actually, they're pretty young guys.
When did you pick up your first instrument, and was it a guitar?
I got a guitar from my Aunt Elizabeth, who was a Kentucky Anglophile who got arthritis really bad and became eccentric. She couldn't leave the house that well, and she was an opera fanatic. So she put a radio tuned to the public station so she could hear the New York Metropolitan Opera in every room in her house, in the hallways, in the bathroom, in the kitchen, in her living room, in her front room, on her porch. There was a radio, and you didn't touch it because the dial was to the public station, which would play the New York Metropolitan Opera Company's performances. And bless her heart, she, of all people, saw me getting interested in the Beatles and bought me a guitar for $30 in 1964 or 5, and that got me going.
We go to Sid Griffin and his band, the Long Riders, and the tune, Stitch in Time.
Thank you.
Our Points North guest, Sid Griffin, fronting the Los Angeles-based band The Long Riders and the tune Stitch in Time from the mid-80s. Sid Griffin joins us on the phone from his home in London, England. You eventually moved to Los Angeles and, after a couple of other outfits, formed the group The Long Riders, which produced some great sides. I mean, I listen to those records from time to time and they really stand up. What was the scene like when you put that band together? What drew you to Los Angeles specifically?
There, I can be very succinct here, very, very on the case. There was a magazine called, not Record Collector, now I can't remember, Record World, was it? No, that's wrong, too. It was a free giveaway based on Rolling Stone, but a free giveaway in the 70s. And in this magazine, the late, great Greg Shaw had a column, as did Rodney Bingenheimer. And I read about this band called the Sex Pistols. And they had been to London and seen this band, and it said they were young guys, they were my age, and they weren't very good, and they did souped-up versions of 60s hits and some of their own originals, and kids their age went nuts. When I read this article, Peter, I thought, I can do that. My band does this. We do souped-up versions of 60s songs, and we're not very good either. So because these two writers were based out of a Phonograph Record, that was the name of the magazine, Phonograph Record. Because Phonograph Record and these two guys, Greg Shaw and Rodney Bingenheimer, were based out of Hollywood, and I loved the Birds anyway, I thought, well, I'll go to Hollywood. So I turned 21 and hit the road, driving across America 2,200 miles from Kentucky by myself to California. And what's interesting is, lo and behold, when I got there, just by luck, by L-U-C, two of the first guys I fell in with were the late Greg Shaw and Rodney Bingenheimer, just by luck. So anyway, I was in some bands that weren't very good, and the Long Riders came together. It was one of those situations where synthesizer music from Britain was so dominant with Kaga Juju and Haircut 100 and Tears for Fears and all those kind of acts, the early Duran Duran, you couldn't get a look in. So myself and a lot of these people that I hadn't quite met yet that would later be the Bangles, the Rain Parade or Mazzy Star, Green on Red, Dream Syndicate, so on and so forth. A lot of these, and Dwight Yoakam, a lot of these people were right in the neighborhood and I hadn't met them yet. But we all had these sort of guitar-based bands that were somewhat 60s, somewhat roots rock oriented, because that was the only way you were going to hear this music. We loved punk. But I thought someone like X was so overpowering in L.A., I couldn't do that. And Black Flag, I couldn't do that. I couldn't do the Circle Jerks. Those boxes were ticked, if you will, Peter. And then the Blasters and Los Lobos came out, and I thought, well, I can't really do those kind of things. What can I bring to the party? And I thought about, I really thought almost like a mathematician. I thought, this is over 30 years ago, I thought, what if you had a band that had the 12-string and rhythm guitar attack of the Birds, right? But had harmonies and good vocals and good songs and had a punk sort of rhythm section. What would happen if you did that kind of thing? And that's how we came up with the Long Riders. I found three other guys that got that message, and we formed the Long Riders.
Good bands are always about chemistry and a personal and musical chemistry. And maybe you could give us a little insight into what you four gentlemen clicked on and where the intersections were. And because there was a real great sense of urgency with that band. There was a great melodic sense, great storytelling, too, when you listen to some of those tunes. You had so many great elements.
I like to think we were the Velvet Underground of our day, and that we only sold 50,000 copies of those three albums, but each person formed a roots rock band. We helped get the Jayhawks going. The guys that later in Sunvolt, Uncle Tupelo, Wilco now, were in a punk band in the St. Louis area that was based on Black Flag. We did an in-store at their store, and Jeff Tweedy and the guys decided they'd rather do what we were doing than be an imitation Black Flag band. There was a band called Mr. Crow's Garden with Chris Robinson and his brother. After exposure to the Long Riders, they morphed into the Black Crows. We really left our mark, even though ourselves as a band didn't sell a lot of CDs, didn't sell a lot of LPs, rather. And what it was is I was sort of the captain of the ship or the ringleader of the street gang saying, let's rob a bank. And I didn't have the tools to crack the safe or steer the ship. So you had a great guy like Greg Souders, who was just the great Charlie Watts drummer of all time. And being a native Californian, his favorite band were the Stones and the Clash. But he understood the dreamlike power of something like the Birds. So he was doing that. And then after that, you had Tom Stevens on the bass, who was from Indiana, and just a real rock solid melodic bass player in the sense that Paul McCartney is, or that Chris Hillman's a melodic bass player. And that really, really helps. I can't tell bands, get rid of the root note bass. Get a bass player that plays in the McCartney, Chris Hillman style, and your whole band will sound fatter and wider and taller, just a much bigger, wider sound. And then on guitar, the icing on the cake was we had this good-looking Jackson Browne ringer, Stephen McCarthy, who he looked like Jackson Browne or Jude Law, but he could play like Clarence White or Tony Rice. So we really had something going back then. And when I look at old film clips of us, I think, God, you know, good-looking band, good songs, the haircuts, it all looks like an image. Why didn't it take? And, of course, the reason was there was nowhere to go. We went as far as we could. Radio weren't playing our kind of thing. And so now we're this band that people keep talking about and referencing, and people do covers of us. And, you know, I see a check from Spain for somebody who's done a cover of another song and so on and so forth. I wished it had happened for us at the time, Peter, but it just – we took it as far as we could. That literally was nowhere else to go.
What were some of the highlights for you in the Long Riders' existence?
God, oh, there were a lot. We went a lot of places, and the first time we went there, there was either no crowd or a huge crowd the second time, or the scenario was the people there the first time didn't get it, and the second time we went, they went bananas. They'd never seen a lap steel. They'd never seen a pedal steel. They'd never seen a guy like me play the auto harp. Sometimes Steven would play the mandolin. They'd never seen that. They'd never seen a guy or heard a guy play guitar like Steven in the Clarence White sense. Now, perhaps, if you'll allow me to guess your age, you're familiar with Clarence White and his work on Great Birds albums like Untitled.
Had the great pleasure of seeing him, yeah.
Yeah, and he's unbelievable. But to a lot of people at the time, and I guess now, sadly, they had no idea what Clarence was doing and hadn't heard his music. So there was no Chuck Berry, Keith Richards to Stevens playing. It was no Eric Clapton, no Carlos Santana. It was this new style. So it really made us stand out and be different. Now, in a way, that's good. And in some instances, that's bad, because we really were the only guys out there for a while. I mean, we were just it. And, you know, as we went along, we were the number one indie band in the world for a while. The Replacements were our rivals here, and the Smiths were our rivals in the UK. We had the number one indie album, College Radio Americana indie album, twice. Not once. We had it twice. And it just didn't happen because, as I said, we went as far as we could. But I must tell you one of the great memories I have, one single solid memory. This just popped into my brain after that editorializing I gave you, Peter. MTV, believe it or not, was really good to us. Radio, a tough one. Couldn't get airplay. Concert promoters didn't understand a lot of things, so we were stuck in theaters. But by God, those people at MTV that a lot of people make fun of were really kind to us. Okay. MTV had this huge day out at UCLA. I remember the Alarm were headlining. We were second on the bill. Blah, blah, blah. MTV were filming, and they'd filmed us and put us on the air at live shows before. So now there's something like 20,000 kids at this. It was outside and free. So there's 20,000 kids at this MTV thing. And we are live on MTV for half an hour before the Alarm doing an hour set. And we're the second to last band of like six or seven. We go into our encore of Looking for Lewis and Clark. And two things, people are screaming and jumping up and down, yelling. I thought, oh my God, we're going to be famous. We've got 20,000 people rocking. And two things happen, which I'll never forget, Peter. Here's one. I saw a kid about 30, 40 feet back in the audience, a fraternity boy, and he's eating Chips Ahoy chocolate chip cookies because I could see the bag. And he takes one of the cookies and acts like he's going to throw it at me. And by God, he does. And the cookie, while I'm on TV, the cookie goes straight as an arrow, straight as an arrow. You know, it's like a frisbee. It goes straight for my head, and it hits me in the head. And I'm on TV, so I can't go, ow, or anything like that. I've just got to get hit in the head humiliatingly. Seconds later, within 20 seconds later, I hear this primal cry to my right, and I hear this discord. There's a cherry picker with a cameraman on it, and he's zooming all around the band filming. This is live on MTV, my friends. We'll be right back. he's flying all around the band in this cherry picker, zooming in and out of our nostrils and earlobes, filming the band. As he came by Tom Stevens, the bass player, somehow the corner of the cherry picker with a cameraman in it locked in between two of the tuning pegs, two of the keys at the top of Tom Stevens' Fender bass. It lifted Tom into the air, and Tom is now 1 foot, 2 foot, 3 foot, 4 foot, 5 feet suspended in the air by his bass guitar. And the audience is howling with laughter. And no, I'll never forget it. Looking over to my right and seeing my bass player carried into the air as if by an alien spaceship. But alas, it was an MTV cameraman.
This needs to be documented in a movie script or a treatment. Sid.
If you had Christopher Guest and the fellas that do Best in Show,
right.
Mighty Wind, Spinal Tap, write a script, they might hesitate to say that happened. My friends, I saw it. I was there. And Tom, and only people yelling and screaming and waving got the guy in the cabin to take the cherry picker back down to earth because the cameraman was oblivious to what was going on. He could have really been hurt.
Well, no kidding. I'd love to go to something else from State of Our Union. I'm a big fan of WDIA and also Lights of Downtown. Do you want to pick another tune from...
I'll tell you what we should pick. Yeah. We should pick Lights of Downtown, and let me tell you why briefly. The late Lee Brillo, the lead singer of Dr. Feelgood, died April 7th, 1994. We've just had the 20th anniversary of his passing. Lee Brillo was a dear friend of mine, and Lee Brillo and the Dr. Feelgood guys cut Lights of Downtown for the B-side of a single back in the day, and that really meant something back then. So let's play Lights of Downtown and dedicate it to Dr. Feelgood's late great lead singer, Lee Brillo.
Pack it in, never coming back here again. Paid my dues and stayed in line. 16 years to serve my time. Now what I did, I do regret. All the days that I had wept, up all night and you can bet, I've gotta live with that. See the lights of downtown, where I shot that old man. Say, how could he just walk away? Had a gun, no daughter, no son. One life is gone and one begun. Now what I did, I do regret. All the days that I had wept, up all night and you can bet, I gotta live with that. See the lights in downtown, where I shot that old man. Can't run away.
We heard a slice of Looking for Lewis and Clark as performed by the Long Riders in the midst of that last clip of conversation. And we heard in its entirety Lights of Downtown, which is also found on the Long Riders' State of the Union recording. Those tunes suggested by our Points North guest, Sid Griffin, who fronted the Long Riders. Today, Griffin lives in London, England, where he has recorded a number of albums with his acoustic band, the Cole Porters, and written a number of books. Sid Griffin, thank you once again for joining us on Points North as we wind up this series after 4 years. You've obviously been under the spell, and I mean, you've mentioned their names, Clarence White and the Byrds, a couple of times so far in this interview, but you've been under the spell of that band for a very long time. And commendably, you've certainly done your best through the years to make sure that new audiences are tuned into those sounds. Do you remember first hearing music by those groups and how it affected you? And I'm interested in, you mentioned who you met first when you got to L.A., but getting to see or hang out with Hillman and all those guys who were part of that scene.
Well, what happened was I was a mid-level fan of the Byrds, and I got ill again and was hospitalized. This is about 6 years after the first time. And my uncle went to the record store to buy an LP to cheer up his nephew. And he saw these guys with long hair and beards on album covers and thought, well, I don't want that. So he bought Sweetheart of the Rodeo because it had a very innocent cover. And I played it and I didn't understand it at first, as most kids about 15 wouldn't have understood it. I didn't get it at first, but the penny began to drop the more I played it. Because in those days, many people remember, you know, when you're a kid, you don't have a lot of money. You buy an album by Joe Schmo. And if you don't like it the first few times, you keep playing it, praying there'll be something on it, one song or one reason to like the album, because you've just spent your hard-earned few dollars on it, right? So I did learn to love Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and from there I went and bought the rest of the catalog, and when they broke up I was just heartsick. And I am a big fan of the Byrds, and I think there's two main reasons. The first is, if you listen to the Byrds catalog, you've heard your share of North American music. You've heard not just Byrd music. You've heard four great singer-songwriters, five, I'll throw in Graham, five great singer-songwriters. You've heard Bob Dylan. You've heard Roger McGuinn do these amazing jazz guitar John Coltrane solos. You've heard Clarence White play amazing solos. You've heard straight country and western. You've heard some rock and roll. You've heard folk rock, psychedelic rock, blah, blah, blah. You've heard some bluegrass. So just listen to the Byrds catalog. You get a lot of North American music right there. There's even some fine fiddle on Sweetheart of the Rodeo and on Untitled. So that's reason one. And reason two, I love the Byrds so much, is there's nothing quite like the Byrds. Most rock and rolls can be boiled down to an electric guitar, a guy in a leather jacket, and an aggressive attitude towards women. The Byrds didn't wear leather jackets, and they sure used electric guitars, but they don't have any sort of misogynistic lyrics. All the Byrd lyrics, oh, there's some naive hippie Byrd lyrics, but all the Byrd lyrics are basically based on justice, peace, brotherhood, anti-war, you know, and I really, really appreciate that a great, great deal. And that meant a great deal to me as a kid, means a great deal to me now. They're just completely set apart. There's nothing like them in that catalog.
In 1985, you wrote a biography on Graham Parsons that is a great resource for anyone who wants a deeper appreciation of the music that he made and the musicians he worked with. It found a home, which I'd never noticed before until I decided to do this interview, that it was Sierra Bryar, a company that also released some of Graham's music and that of his peers who published the book. You got to people while memories were still fresh, which I think is a very important thing about this book. And that must have been a very interesting project for you to work on. And I would imagine you had to win over a few people.
Well, I think once I had Chris Hillman's affection and respect, he and I subsequently become pretty good buddies. I was away at the races. He was the most difficult one to kind of get to know. And once you had Hillman on board, you were laughing, basically. It's hard, you know, you meet Roger McGuinn and you meet Crosby. And I guess now that I think about it, I've shaken every single Byrd's hand and been in every single Byrd's company of the original five. I didn't realize that until just now. I have everybody's autograph on an LP of Turn, 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 save Crosby's. But I've met Crosby for Mojo Magazine and written about him. And we're email buddies and I've shaken his hand. So one day I'll have David sign it. I will tell you this. When I was leaving L.A. to come to London, I went in Rhino Records, where I used the record store, not the label. And I used to work there part-time when I needed some bucks, and there was nothing going on. I went in Rhino, and they said, we've got something for you as a going-away present. And they gave me a Turn, Turn, Turn vinyl copy, a used one. And I said, well, you know, great. But I mean, of course I have this. Is it because it's mono you want me to have it? And they said, no, open it up. And I opened it up, and there was an 8x10 black and white photograph of the original five birds, and all five of them had signed it.
Oh, nice.
All five of them had signed it. And so the Rhino of the store gave that to me as a going away present. It's framed. It's on my wall. And of course, now I'm sure you could sell it for, you know, I don't know what, thousands of dollars to somebody. I mean, Gene's on it, Crosby's on it, McGuinn's on it, the Clarks are on it. It's incredible.
Why don't you pick a tune from each of the Graham Parsons and Chris Hillman tribute discs? Well, actually, let's go first to if there's a favorite bird tune off the top of your head that, you know, a place where you still go that you go, man, that just knocks me out every time. I'm sure there's a bunch of them, but pick a bird.
Well, there's a bunch of them, but I would say if it had to right off the top of my head, I would say Chimes of Freedom off the very, very, very first album is just majestic. I mean, there's just, you know, other rock bands. If they did that, they were imitating the Birds.
We go to the Birds with Chimes of Freedom, as written by Bob Dylan.
Far between sundown's finish and midnight's broken tone, inside the doorway, thunder crashing. As majestic bells and phones struck shadows in the sound, seeming to be the chimes of freedom flashing. Flashing for the warriors whose strength is not to fight. Flashing for the refugees on the unarmed road of flight. And for each and every underdog soldier in the night. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing. Even though a cloud's white curtain in a far-off corner, darkness was slowly lifting. Electric lights still struck like arrows, fired but for the ones condemned to drift or else be kept from drifting.
Tolling for the searching ones on their speechless seeking trail. For the lonesome-hearted lovers with too personal a tale. And for each unharmful gentle soul misplaced inside a jail. And we gazed upon the chimes of freedom flashing.
As chosen by our guest Sid Griffin, we heard the Birds performing Bob Dylan's Chimes of Freedom. Griffin's knowledge of the Birds is second to none, and he has not only written about the band and specific members of the legendary group, he has spearheaded tribute recordings to one-time Birds Chris Hillman and Graham Parsons with his band The Cole Porters. Sid Griffin joins us on the phone from his home in London, England, where he has lived for almost a quarter of a century. You ended up moving to England, which is where we're talking to you from today, Sid Griffin. And what precipitated that? And when you headed overseas, did you have full intention of going there for what seems to be the rest of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't. I came over. I thought I'd be here a few years, and I've met an English-Welsh gal, and I now live here, and I'm staring at one of my little boys who's asleep on the sofa. He's overdone his nap, and he'll wake up crying in a minute. And that's just, I'm sure all your listeners that hear me say that can relate. You go somewhere or you do something. Maybe you haven't even left your hometown, but you went to the grocery store or you went to a party and you met somebody and your life changes. That's what happened to me when I was in London. I was here a lot. The Long Riders did really well in Europe, so we were here a lot. And the next thing I knew, I was over here on a vacation, bumped into somebody, married him. And now I'm doing the sort of rootsy scene here in London, England. And it's interesting because some places in Europe don't want to know, and some places they're just fanatical for the kind of thing I do. They just go nuts. It's just a crazy world.
When did you actually land there, and when did you feel like you had started to get your feet firmly planted on the ground there musically?
I came over in February 1992, so I've been here a long time. I've been here. I just realized the other day I've been in England longer than I've been in my native Kentucky. But again, that's what happens when you marry and you have kids. People are always making comparisons to their hometown and the place they moved to. And you just got to say, look, they're two different places. I mean, I'm always having people saying, what's the difference between England and Kentucky or England and California? It's like, you know,
everything. I mean,
there's two different places. And because we both speak English, people want continual comparisons. And I'm sure it's the same for Canadians. I mean, if we spoke German in the United States or French, I wouldn't get asked that question so often because we share the same language. I do. But I mean, it's like anything else. My take of Europe is this: where the Celtic peoples have gone or reside, be it Ireland, Wales, Scotland, certainly the northwest corner of Spain, Galicia and all that, where there's Celtic people, they love this kind of bluegrass country fiddle music. Where the United States Army was the army of occupation after the Second World War, that is northern Italy, the Bavaria part of Germany, Czech Republic, so on and so forth, they go bananas for bluegrass and country and western because they have that experience from the GIs playing them that stuff. So those are the pockets that we keep going to. And although we play, say, Sweden and other places, the non-Romantic language countries, the countries that are Anglo-Saxon and North Central Europe, they don't quite get it on the same primal level that the people get it that are Celtic, or the people get it that are part of the great mass that were under the United States Army after the Second World War. We've got a Canadian fiddler in our band, and she and I talk about this. It's the most notable thing that the fiddle and the banjo sound goes down the stream where the Celtic people have been, or where the American or the Canadians or the army of occupation after the war. And in other places, it's fairly new to them. But, you know, just good music goes down a storm anywhere. It just depends. I mean, I'm doing a different thing now with acoustic music. I'm just doing a different thing. So you can't expect the exact same people to follow you. I mean, in the old days when you formed a new band, when Clapton formed a new band, people followed him. I mean, you know, leaves the Blues Breakers and he goes into Cream and he goes into Derek and the Dominoes and he goes solo or whatever and people follow him. But those days are long over. I mean, the Sex Pistols break up and I'm sure a lot of people were repulsed by Public Image LTD. You know, the days of you carrying your audience with you are over. Each time you have a new band, they're going to judge you again. So, I mean, we've lost some fans after the Longriders days and I've gained some. It's not everybody's made the leap. And it's funny, every gig I do, people come up and say, I saw you in the Long Riders. Not most gigs I do, every. We did a UK tour of 11 dates in March, and every night people came up and said, I remembered you from the Long Riders, so I figured you're worth a ticket. It was great. Every night.
A lot of great folk musicians in the UK. How easy was it to find people you were compatible with right out of the gate, and what's the process? It's been a pretty interesting evolution when you look at the Cole Porters. I think your current band is a fantastic band. Certainly the
Yeah, we've done very well with this last record of ours, Find the One, produced by the great John Wood, who's the guy behind the early Fairport Convention successes such as Liege and Leaf and the Nick Drake albums, the late great Nick Drake. He later did Squeeze and a Beth Orton album, and John Wood got it's the best sounding record I've ever done, Find the One. And by the way, folks, it's Cole Porter, C-O-A-L, like a chunk of coal. So look up C-O-A-L, not the guy's name. It's a pun, it's a homonym. And I just think that we're really lucky to have the firepower we've got. I mean, I hold down a certain reputation and can put bums on the seats, as they say in the English theater districts. And people like Carly Fryer, British Columbia fiddler, and John Breeze on banjo, they really get an audience going with, you know, technical virtuosity. I mean, Carly's a brilliant fiddler. She could be an Alison Krauss in Union Station or Ricky Skaggs in Kentucky Thunder. John had a master's degree in classical guitar from the University of Southampton. So he's an incredible musician. So I've been very lucky to have these people in the band. And I think it shows in the Find the One album that the Cole Porters did. I think you can hear it.
Neil's still in the band?
Yeah, Neil Hurd's been with me, I think, 14, 15 years now. He and I will probably die together. He's just the greatest. He's doing sound tonight. I can't remember who's on tour, but he does sound for some bands when they're over here from the States. And he did sound for the Old Crow Medicine Show and so many other bands like that. He's doing sound on a quick tour right now. And then we meet up April 22nd to begin rehearsals for the next Cole Porter's record, which will be out in the autumn. We started April – well, we don't start the album. We start rehearsals April 22nd.
You were mentioning John Wood. How did you connect with him?
I met Joe Boyd and John Wood years ago in passing, and Joe Boyd and John Wood were the tandem that did these great records at Fairport Convention, Nick Drake. And the last record we had done at that time was April 2009. We did a record with Ed Stasium in Colorado called Durango. And that was real. It was with Carly on fiddle. And that was really an experience. Now, Ed is the main guy behind, of all things, the Ramones. He was Phil Spector's lead engineer for years and years and years. And he did the last Long Riders record, Two Fisted Tales. So that was a great experience, but it was expensive taking the band to Colorado to record. So what we did was we thought we got to record in London. Who can we think of? And I don't know why it took me forever to think of John Wood. I don't know why it took me forever, but we got John. He lives in Scotland now, but he comes down to London for work all the time on the train. And so John did the album with us. And the other thing John does is he does sound for a lot of TV. He's really doing well in life, John. And he's not semi-retired. He's past retirement age. I don't think he'll mind me telling your listeners. But John Wood is really one of the great engineers /producers/ record men of the British record industry. And I can't say enough good things about him. The records he's made, like Lesion Leaf by Fairport Convention, not only is the performance he helped get the band to do amazing, but the records sound amazing. And that really is something when you put those two things together.
What did he get out of the Cole Porters that maybe past producers hadn't?
He can be this sort of avuncular, joking, warm, sort of grumpy relative that tricks you into doing things you didn't know you could do. I mean, I do things, you know, we did as much live as we could. We're a bit Neil Young, Willie Nelson. We like to do things live. And then just see if there's any obvious mistakes or if it's got the feel. And John gets the band to do things they didn't think they could do. And he's also very good at saying, Sid, this is a crazy idea of yours, and we can go for it, but this is what's going to entail. You know, a lot of producers just say, no, we can't do that. John never says that. He says, we can do that, but this is what it means is going to happen. And he gives you all the ups and downs, the whys and wherefores. And I think that's brilliant. I don't like being told we can't do it. I don't mind being told it's going to take time or it's going to take money. But I don't like producers and engineers that ever tell me we can't do that. You know, that's just no way to go into a project. And John Wood's very good at saying, okay, yeah, we can do that. But it's going to cost this and it's going to take this amount of time. And that I really loved. Plus, he's just a great guy to have around. There's always downtime in the studio. And John always has an accurate, pertinent, germane story to the problem at hand. You can always lean back and say, when I met the band, Levon Helm told me the best way to record the drums was, and you get this marvelous story. So that's something I loved about him, just listening to him talk.
We go to the Cole Porters' Find the One recording from 2012, and this is the song, Never Right His Wrong.
He came back one hot September night. He said, I've been lost, but I can make it right. You know I fear your lies, lest we forget. Here I am, love, the rest I regret. Hung his hat upon that old nail in the wall and looked around, thought, man, she's dull. So many days and nights that starred prairie sky, all he'd been looking for is some kind of sign.
His arms are open, his eyes like the dawn,
but she yet the same since he's been gone.
His mind was made up, the past and all the song,
but she knew then that he'd never right his wrong. Turned her back, wiped the sweat from her brow, knew she couldn't bear even one more hour. In the glass of his old Yukon Jack, looking out for her heart, felt the cracks. Excuse me, honey, I'll be right back. Crept downstairs, found some kind of sack. Threw in some memories, said, can't do this no more. Turned on her heel and just bolted out that door.
His arms were open, eyes like the dog on.
But she ain't the same since he's been gone.
Mine was made up.
But she knew then that he'd never had his wrong.
Mm-hmm.
had come, but she didn't feel a thing. Past the wheat fields, you could almost hear them sing. Now the whistle of her own office train, taking her away, it's too sweet refrain. No more grain, gas, and yellow canola fields. Eyes are waiting on Pacific Ocean teal. Sky is clear now, West Coast eagle soars. This train is bound for a Rocky Mountain shore.
His arms were open, his eyes like the dawn.
But she ain't the same since he's been gone.
His mind was made up, past an older song.
But she knew then that he'd never had his own.
His arms were open, his eyes like the dawn.
She ain't the same since he's been gone. His mind was made up, past an older song. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong, yeah. She knew then that he'd never right his wrong.
Our Points North guest, Sid Griffin, and his band that features Canadian fiddle player Carly Frey and British multi-instrumentalist Neil Robert Hurd. The track we just heard is Never Right His Wrong. Wanted you to talk about your career in journalism. You've dovetailed that in your music career quite nicely. You wrote the book on Graham, and then it was another 20 years before you wrote another book, but I presume there was a lot of writing articles for magazines and such. And when did you decide that you were going to make that an integral part of your career?
Well, what happened was I had a degree in journalism from the University of South Carolina. So I was already writing this and writing that, and it worked out really well. But what I didn't realize was I didn't realize that a book would be such a struggle. The first book I did was that thing on Graham, which I like a great deal. When I wrote a book on bluegrass called Bluegrass Guitar, Know the Players, Play the Music. That was good. And then the next thing I did was I wrote a book called Million Dollar Bash on Bob Dylan and the Basement Tapes, which has done extremely well for me. And, of course, now T-Bone Burnett is going to do they've taken unreleased Bob Dylan lyrics, and they're going to have a series of people write music to those lyrics, and they're going to film the good and the great, like Steve Earle, Lucinda Williams, Roseanne Cash, doing Basement Tape songs. And I'm thinking I might be involved in that project, or so Sam Jones says, and I'm hoping I will. So that did well for me. And then I did another book called Shelter from the Storm, the Rolling Thunder Review on Bob Dylan. And that did almost as well as the Basement Tapes book. So I'm actually quite pleased with the way the writing's been. My third and last Dylan book is on his so-called Jesus years. And I've been working on it for years, and it'll take another 2 years, 3 years to get out. It's like Million Dollar Bash. It's a real serious academic work. So I'm still writing. In the Longriders days, I kept my hand in it, and every once in a while wrote a magazine article or whatever. But I didn't write a book. And now that I've written four books, my hat's off to any author, be it some guy doing an academic research book, or Stephen King writing his mystery murder novels, or myself or some other guy writing a book on Neil Young or Bob Dylan or whatever, to really churn out 50,000 to 100,000 solid words and not waste the reader's time. That's a real talent, a real talent.
It's been a real pleasure. I've wanted to talk to you for a long time, Sid, and I'm glad we were finally able to track you down. And it's just a nice way to end a four-year series, you know, where we've had everybody from Greg Allman to a gentleman early on that you mentioned, Joe Boyd, was on this show early on, out of the gate.
Great.
And I would like you to leave us with one more tune from the Cole Porter's Find the One recording, one that works really well live and one you're particularly proud of. And I just want to say, this show has been about music and all facets of music, whether it's journalism or documentary filmmakers or producers. And I think you're just a great way to finish up this series, as you have your hands and your talents in so many different pools. And thanks for the great body of work you've put together and the way you've helped keep the great music of other fine artists alive.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, Peter. If I had to leave you and your listeners with one musical nugget from me, I would say it's on Find the One by the Cole Porters. I would say the song is called Hush You Babe, / Burnham Thorpe. Hush You Babe is my song. I sing and play the banjo. And then it breaks into a marvelous Canadian fiddle hoedown by our Canadian fiddler, Carly Fry, who will be thrilled to be on this network and was so thrilled when I told her I was going to speak to you today. I kid you not. So that'll be a great way to end it.
As we make our way out of this, the last new installment of Points North, I would once again like to thank all the talented individuals who accepted invitations to appear on this show over the last 4 years. And a very special thank you to you, the listeners, the loyal audience who supported Points North. Once again, CKUA will be airing a Best of Points North that will run through to the 2014 fall fundraiser. Again, thanks to Sid Griffin for joining us on the phone from his home in London, England. And we leave you with his band, the Cole Porters, with very special guest Richard Thompson on guitar and the track Hush You Babe that rolls into Burnham Thorpe. Cheers for now.
Hush you, babe. Keep it quiet. No more tears. You best deny it. We're on our own. We had to try it. Hush, child, don't you cry or weep, and pray the Lord your soul to keep. This train, it has no track of time, but my family is still all mine. Dear heart, we're so alone. Just remember, we're headed home. You trust your mom, we love you so. And I'm scared, what can I do? So very scared, right through and through. Good Shepherd, please bless this road. For your cargo's a heavy load, full of hope and fright and rage, but another cage. Ten miles a night without a word. Is that a hound that I just heard? We're found. Side by side, we'll lay in heaven's ground. Papa's right, we must not fall until we rest beneath Selima Hall. Then cross the Ohio on a raft of birch to raise our voices loud in town clock church. I smell magnolia on the vine. Just taste the air. Someone's getting close. I pray it's not the Holy Ghost. A few more miles and then we're there. I love you, all I do, I swear. Thank you.
been listening to Points North, produced and hosted by Peter North. Technical production, Duke Pates. Points North is a production of the CKUA Radio Network.